Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, May 16th, 2018. We start with the news section today. Jailbreak. For the second straight year, Southerners on new ground celebrate Mother's Day by bailing black women out of the Durham County Detention Center. On Wednesday afternoon, the sun is beaming down on the courtyard of the Durham County Detention Facility, where about two dozen women are gathered. A small group forms a circle and begins a call and response, their words reverberating off the jail's high gray walls. "If you can hear me, say power," Serena Sebring follows. "Power," the group responds. "And transformation. Transformation. And miracles. And miracles. And miracles," Sebring cries out, her companions responding in turn. They are here to make miracles happen for women of color locked up inside the jail because they cannot pay to get out. It's the second year that Southerners on New Ground, a queer liberation group for which Sebring is a regional organizer, has held the Black Mama's Bailout in Durham, raising money to purchase the freedom of black women, trans, and gender nonconforming people who are mothers and caregivers just ahead of Mother's Day. Moments earlier, the first woman freed, Lisa Oxendine, a mother of two, had emerged from the jail's glass doors. Sebring handed her a bouquet of flowers and led her to a social worker to talk about housing, employment, and any other need she might have after 8 days in the jail under a $1,000 bond on the charge of breaking into a truck. Sitting next to the social worker, Oxendine lifts the bouquet to her face and smiles. Seeing a message written in marker on the brown paper wrapping, "We see you, we love you, welcome home." That was initially planned as a one-day action, turned into four, as the organization continued to collect donations and secure the release of women in the jail. By the end of Saturday, they have spent $18,900 on bail for nine women. Black Mama's bailouts and similar actions were held across the country amid a growing call for bail reform. Southerners on New Ground, founded in Durham, held bailouts in seven cities this last year. In the last year in Durham, Song freed 14 women for Mother's Day. "Time was passing. I was missing things like trying to find a job, my children," says Sade Ray, the second woman freed this year, who was released after Song paid the $400 in unpaid child support that kept her in the jail, along with a probation violation, for 46 days. Like Ray, who has five children, 80% of the women held in America's jails are mothers, and the majority are women of color. Nationally, about 60% of women in local jails have been convicted of crime, and about three-quarters of them are awaiting trial for nonviolent crimes, according to the Prison Policy Initiatives. Because of wage and wealth disparities, women, and particularly women of color, are less likely to post bail. Unable to get to work or pay rent, they may lose their home or job. Research also suggests people held pretrial are more likely to take a guilty plea. For Courtney Sebring, one of two money handlers for the action, and Serena's daughter, seeing each other exit the jail felt like when you see your family member at a reunion that you haven't seen in 10 years. "This work," she says, "resonates with me personally and someone who understands the inside population of the jail as a whole, in a place where black folks and black women in particular are targeted to be kidnapped and held there. It feels really important to me to be able to be part of a campaign that is bringing home some of the most important people in our community, black women, black mothers, who are so essential to our survival, our family structure, and do so much work to care for us." In addition to bailing women out, Song freed another two women by convincing judicial officials, who set bail amounts, to unsecure their bonds, meaning they don't have to pay in order to get out, only if they miss court. We're finding out the power of just asking for a bond reduction works more often than you'd think, Serena Sebring says. Sebring says the bailout is worth doing on its own merit. People get to go home, but it's also part of a larger campaign by Song to end the system of money bail across the South, including Durham. Instead, the activists want to see pretrial release alternatives that don't put money people under excessive supervision and investments in what they need to get to court, stay out of jail, and live safe, stable lives. Bailouts are a tactic that allow us to do a few things, Sebring says. First and foremost, to visualize what it would look like if we were to win, if we were to end money bail. What would it look like if the families being reunited? It would look like people going back to their lives. It would look like community support and resources being offered. And it would look like freedom. People coming out of cages. The goal seems more attainable after last week, when Durham voters elected a new district attorney and sheriff who have been vocal about reforming the bail system, and Google and Facebook announced they would ban ads for bail bond companies. In the context of the campaign, this week was kind of a huge watershed, Sebring says, and an opportunity for our community to really change the conversation about community safety here in Durham. The next news article, The Dust Settles. What to make of last week's Wake County Commissioner races? Perhaps no one was more surprised by the result of last week's Wake County Democratic primaries than Vicki Adamson. I had a concession speech prepared, but not a victory speech, she said. Everybody kept telling me, you can't win. But I did. Indeed she did, though not by much, about 2,000 votes out of 61,000 cast. Still, she unseated a popular, charismatic, and better-funded incumbent in Commissioner John Burns and caught most local politicals, Burns included, flat-footed. That wasn't the only surprise May 8th held. The former school board member Susan Evans defeated Commissioner Irv Portman. That wasn't a shock, but the margin was jaw-dropping, 62-38. And Commissioner Matt Calabria, a young progressive thought to have a bright political future, had more trouble than he anticipated, holding off challenger Lindy Brown by a scant 2,000 votes. Each contest had its idiosyncrasies. Byrd was dinged by Adamson's accusation that he bullied her in a public forum a week before the election. Bad optics in what is shaping up to be the year of the woman. Calabria was aided by the Brown campaign's ill-advised Facebook post lamenting tax increases to fund schools, which fed into Calabria's line that she was more conservative than voters realized. And then there was Portman, who found himself in the untenable position of warning progressive primary voters against being too progressive. But these races also had connective tissue. These three incumbents, along with Commissioner Sig Hutchinson, who won his primary easily, are all straight white men who had all backed last year's budget, which critics said underfunded schools. Their challengers, with the exception of Hutchinson's, were all women running on a pro-schools platform backed by two well-heeled liberal donors. It's hard to overstate the impact that Dean Debnan and Ann Campbell had on the county commissioner's race. Both had supported the incumbents before, felt betrayed by their school funding vote last year, and had the resources to do something about it. They and their spouses poured more than $100,000 into these contests, and their PACs, Debnan's Wake Citizens for Good Government, and Campbell's Women Awake, raised at least $50,000. The Debmans and Campbells alone accounted for more than two-thirds of the money Adamson's raised. In an email, Campbell says the results prove that Wake County voters value gender diversity in education. Looking ahead, she writes, all candidates on the ballot in Wake County in November would be wise to demonstrate their commitment to public education. Debman could not be reached for comment by press time. Hutchinson takes a more pessimistic view. Whether I was victorious, he said, I don't think there were many winners. The big loser was the Wake County Democratic Party. It was an ugly and brutal fight. Large money donors tried to influence the election, and they were successful. Both Evans and Adamson faced Republican opponents in the fall, though neither is expected to encounter much difficulty. The question is how they'll change the board when they're sworn in 6 months from now. Primaries and elections in general tend to exaggerate differences, Calabria says, sounding a conciliatory note. We are all progressives dealing with a common challenge. I think there is likely to be a lot more unity than some of the dialogue in the primary would suggest. The colleagues I currently serve with have each brought something unique and different to the table, Holmes adds. Moving forward, I anticipate that the board will be even better served by having more diversity of opinions. The next article, Schools Out. Republican lawmakers may dismiss them as union thugs, but the thousands of North Carolina teachers who dissented on Raleigh this week say they're simply looking for respect. And here are some of their stories. Last week I asked my neighbor, a first-year elementary school teacher in Durham, whether she planned to go to the protest in Raleigh on Wednesday. Durham Public Schools, like more than 30 school districts across the state, including the Wake County Public School System, Orange County Schools, and Carborough, Chapel Hill City Schools, were closing on May 6th, the first day of the General Assembly short session. Too many teachers had requested a personal day to participate in the protest. Some 15,000 people at least were expected to rally for better school funding in front of the legislature that morning. My neighbor, however, would not be among them. This is not because she doesn't support the cause. She certainly does. But she'll be there in spirit, she told me. But as it turns out, she was to get a summer job, and Wednesday was the only day she could find time for an interview. If you ask the Republicans who run the General Assembly, these teachers are ungrateful for what lawmakers have done for them in recent years. One state representative, Mark Brody of Union County, posted on Facebook last week that this would be a gathering of teacher union thugs who want to control the education process. Senate leader Phil Berger complained on Twitter that teacher strikes are illegal in North Carolina, and in some respects what we're seeing looks like a work slowdown and looks like a fairly typical union activity, and the people of North Carolina don't support that sort of action. House Speaker Tim Moore's office, meanwhile, blasted out press releases highlighting recent increases in teacher pay. The total teacher pay increase for 2017-18, one release noted, would be 11%, and North Carolina has the second fastest rising teacher pay in the U.S. But North Carolina still badly lags much of the country. Earlier this year, Education Week ranked the state 40th in the country by overall quality, citing insufficient funding a decade ago. The Tar Heel State placed in the top 20. North Carolina is the 39th in school funding, according to the May 16th coalition, which is organizing Wednesday's protest, and 37th in teachers' pay. Thousands of North Carolina teachers work second jobs, and many public school workers qualify for public assistance, the coalition's website explains. Despite an economic recovery since the crash of 2008, North Carolina state lawmakers refuse to invest in our public schools. Adjusted for inflation, a report from the North Carolina Justice Center pointed out last year that the state's per-pupil spending was down nearly 9% in 2016-17 from 2008-09, when the recession took hold. In that same period, per-pupil appropriations for teacher assistance have declined 36%, textbooks 38%, teacher school technology 44%, and supplies and materials 55%. Meanwhile, big urban counties such as Wake have raised taxes to help their school district meet their needs and provide teachers with livable wages. This, of course, isn't just a North Carolina issue. Similar protests have taken root in red states across the country, West Virginia to Kentucky, Arizona to Oklahoma, places where educators feel unappreciated and disrespected, where they're digging into their own pockets to buy school supplies and moonlighting to make ends meet. As the teachers the Indy interviewed for this week cover story will tell you, the same thing is happening here, and they're sick and tired of it. And that's what this protest is all about. Carl Tavares. Carla Tavares is a third-grade teacher at Jones Dairy Elementary in Wake Forest. She came to North Carolina 11 years ago from Rhode Island, where she also taught. Her statement? We work more than 40 hours a week. We work all night, all weekend. I substitute during breaks, and I teach reading camp just to make ends meet. As a single parent, part of this is about being able to sustain my household, being able to send my children to college. But I chose this profession because I feel that it's a calling, and it's a part of my responsibility to advocate for the things that I believe in that are not right. We need our support staff, teacher assistants, not just cutting positions and expecting teachers to do more with less. I know what it's like to be in a classroom where you don't have what you need. I have spent a lot of money on books to accommodate my own needs in my classroom. For me personally, it's about the kids, and I would like to be able to feel like I am respected as a professional. We don't get treated as professionals. If you want your teachers to be happy, you want your schools to have a working community. And there are just so many things that go on with the territory. I took a huge pay cut to come here. And to feel that I am just within the last couple of years making what I was making 11 years ago is pretty pathetic. Simone Kiddo. Simone Kiddo splits her time as the only social worker for Waste Forest View and Southwest Elementary Schools in Durham. She also runs a construction company and a farm with her husband and works as a pool desk attendant at a YMCA and as a Girl Scout troop leader. Her statement. A lot of kids go years without any kind of formal mental health treatment. A kid can't learn if he's got anxiety or depression or ADHD or PTSD. They're not focused on what's going on in the classroom. They're focused on what's going on in their heads. At one of my schools, I share the office with a school psychologist and then also the bilingual family liaison. If she wants to have a meeting, then the two of us need to leave. I can't pull a student and talk to a student because there's no privacy. There's no confidentiality. We usually find somewhere else to go, hallways, nurse's station, which is where the bathroom is. They don't have as good of a relationship with me because they don't see me individually. They don't feel heard, or they don't feel like their time is valuable. So there's a lot of stuff that I think ends up going unaddressed for students when it comes to mental health or social-emotional needs because, one, there's not somebody there that's able to meet with the student, or two, there's just not enough space to do it in. Sam Nguyen. Sam Nguyen is a gifted specialist at Sewell Elementary in Chapel Hill. She's also a mom, tutors, runs a STEAM club, and facilitates teacher development courses for Carrboro Chapel Hill City Schools. She said, if you ask any teacher what they're here for, they're here to do what's best for kids and what serves them well. And that's what I am standing up for, because right now, that's not what's happening. And I'm tired of not saying something. We give and we give, and we know what it's good and what we keep doing it. But as I've entered mid-career, I've had to reassess. How much do I give without getting? I think it's a normal teacher thing that we're so open to giving in that way that we also have to remember to take care of ourselves and advocate for ourselves. Especially with it being Teacher Appreciation Week, I can only take so many thank yous for what you do. It sustains my heart, but it doesn't sustain my family. When it's individual parents saying really meaningful things, those things still matter so much. But it's the empty talk that we get from the people who are in charge, who really haven't spent a day in our shoes, and yet tell us how things are. Eli Seed. Eli Seed is a high school English teacher at the School for Creative Studies in Durham, an educator for 22 years. He also runs a farm with his wife. A lot of students come to us with very little of their own. They're a pretty huge support system for a lot of kids. They're hurting at home, and now that support system is being damaged as well. My largest class right now is 34 students, and that's as many students as I've ever had on a roster. We're not able to do as many projects. We're not able to do as many group-oriented activities because there's just not enough space for it. A few years ago, I had another class of 34, and I only had 31 desks. It was never a factor because there was always a minimum of 3 people absent. That kind of thing that, with the right funding and staffing, people would be looking into, and we would be providing services more effectively. My wife and I were college sweethearts who have been married for over 20 years and live in the same house for over 20 years, and it's an old house that was falling apart, and we fixed it up. We've started a business. We have a little more than 2.5 kids, and they're all cute and spread out. If it wasn't for the fact that I was a public school teacher, we would be just the apple of Senate Leader Filberger's eye, and he would want to hold us up as an example of good Americans, a North Carolina family. Turquoise Parker. Turquoise Parker is a second grade teacher at Eastway Elementary in Durham. In addition to teaching, babysitting, and tutoring, she is also a marching band instructor and competition judge. She said, "I love Eastway so very much, and 100% of what is the children. I have a very strong passion for teaching racial and social justice to elementary kids, and especially doing that with the kids of color, and especially doing that with the kids who were living in the poverty, and some of them are homeless and are of a major life transition. Giving them that information and helping them to become crucial thinkers is going to help them literally break barriers in their own lives, in their own families, change their world, change their entire trajectory. I love to do classroom transformation, where I'll turn my classroom into different things, like I turned it into the Wiz, the Yellow Brick Road. I turned it into a football stadium, a soccer stadium, the Olympics. We did a winter wonderland, so it was snowy and icy and all around the classroom. Last year, I did a surprise field trip with my class to Charlotte for the weekend, and it was the most amazing thing ever. For several of my kids, that truly changed their lives beyond words. The majority of them had never been out of Durham. Literally all the things that make my classroom pop and are engaging and are exciting and make you want to come inside are things that were donated or we bought them." Cheryl Davis. Cheryl Davis teaches fourth grade at Joyner Elementary Magnet School in Raleigh. She previously taught in Virginia for 10 years and has been in North Carolina for 2 years. She has always had a second job. Her statement, I moved to North Carolina in the hopes of not teaching anymore. I was going to walk away. I moved to North Carolina and I got into retail. When I did that, something was missing. So I got into Wake County and I wanted to get back into teaching. And since I'm back in, I'm happy. But my fight in Virginia is the same fight as I'm having in North Carolina, doing more with less. Doing what we're expected to do, and each year things get less and less and less. This is my second year at Joyner Elementary School. It is fantastic. Our administration supports us. Our parents are extremely supportive. However, teachers are very good at using what we have to do and the best that we can. Every day we see children who need extra support. If someone falls and hurts themselves, we have a half-time nurse. We make do with what we have. We're nurses. We're counselors. We pull the weight when it's not there, and we run a well-oiled machine with what we've got. Ever since the day I walked into my own classroom, I've had a second job. From Virginia to North Carolina, I have had a second job. I work at PNC Arena at the box office. I also work at AMF Bowling Alley. The teacher down the hall teaches yoga before school and sometimes after school. Probably very few don't have some additional subsidy to their income. I've had to purchase books and supplies to do science experiments. I just give everybody a fresh pencil, glue sticks, dry erasers, markers, tissue, wipes. I've never not used my own funds. We do it so well that people don't realize how much of it is ours and how late we stayed up to make this experiment or this activity the best that we could possibly make it. A lot of it, that is. I put in the work in the backyard for us to see this on the front. Johannes Kibrit. Johannes Kibrit is a world history and American history teacher at Broughton High School in Raleigh. He also works at your pie in Cary. I don't have a lot of free time. I don't spend a lot of time with friends or family. It's time-consuming and it's exhausting. Every single child has a different learning style, and they process information differently. If you have a classroom size of 32 or larger, it makes it very difficult to plan for the individuals that are in the classroom. So a lot of kids fall between the cracks because I just can't give them the attention that they need to understand the lesson that I planned. It also makes it very difficult to grade. I wouldn't have signed up for this if I knew to the extent what I was signing up for. There's not a month that goes by where I don't think at least once during leaving this profession. I love it, I love the kids, and I love doing what I do. There are no boring days in this job. But I wasn't expecting this as a sophomore in college when I picked my major. I kind of knew what I was signing for in terms of salary, just like everybody else. I understand that. But I did not expect to have a broken air conditioning, broken protractor, paint chipping in my classroom, and class sizes of almost 40 students. Andy Mariatugui. Andy Mariatugui is a fourth-grade English language arts teacher at Eastway Elementary. On weekends, she leads tours at Durham Distillery. She previously worked in Chicago, where teachers are unionized. I was always super grateful and active in my union in Chicago, but hadn't really realized quite how important it was until it was gone. We got paid for having a master's degree and for getting extra credit hours. I have a master's degree and an ESL certification, and all those things increased my pay, as they should. Here you don't have that, so there's less incentive here to seek those advanced degrees and extra over certifications. Advanced teacher degrees and teachers still do it, which is amazing, and shows teacher dedication here in North Carolina. That's a big difference. Speaking about physical items, we have completely run out of pencils. I have a pencil captain who's in charge of keeping the pencils sharpened and passing them out, but also collecting them and making sure that we have the same number that we started with because we can't afford to lose any more at this point. I only have one pack left in my secret cabinet. Hopefully, we make it through the next 4 weeks. Shauna Broders. Shauna Broders is a fifth-grade teacher at Wake Forest Elementary in Wake Forest. She also tutors during the week. If you walk into a classroom that was supplied last week, what the state gives you, it would be the saddest, leery-dreary place ever. Everything you see on those walls, the bright, colorful anything, the teacher has bought and brought into the classroom. You don't get posters. You don't get letters. You don't get anything. Teaching does spread you thin. It does wear you down. I feel like I'm tired and I don't have anything left to give to my kids when I get home. They get shafted for the kids I teach. But I specifically love it when you can open their eyes to something. I never liked reading, and then this year I found something I loved, and I love reading now. I used to hate math, but the way you teach it, like I do now, or I understand it, and you can help someone else understand something, and then maybe find a love of learning that they didn't have before. We now turn to a feature article, Moogfest. Power switch. Can Moogfest help us unlearn the power of patriarchy? In December, Moogfest announced its first wave of programming with a twist. All of the performers and presenters identified as non-binary or female. While lauded by many, the festival's decision wasn't without controversy. Carolyn Polachek, who was announced in the first wave, dropped out of the festival, citing her anger at being unnecessarily othered without her permission. Gender is not a genre, she wrote on Twitter. Well, that's true, but gender and other identity factors have become something of a new guidepost for conscientious consumption. How often do we seek out art made by those whose lives look different than our own? Whose voices look different than our own, whose voices get prioritized on label rosters, magazine covers, festival lineups, and why? What other unlearning of the patriarchy do we still have left to do? It's easy to tie curatorial decisions like this one to the / Me Too movement, wherein those abused by men in positions of power have reclaimed their strength by publicly speaking out against those who did them harm. But a more accurate truth, at least in the music industry, is that people from traditionally marginalized backgrounds are now making the art that's more suited to our times. Artists like Kekila explores intersecting identities through sound, while others like Norway's Jenny Horvel lay back stark personal truths about everything from self-doubt to menstruation. Chelsea Manning, the transgender soldier turned information activist who had to drop an interview with the Indy last minute, delivers the festival's keynote address on Saturday afternoon. But the men of Moogfest have plenty to offer, too. John Hopkins builds immensely beautiful worlds with sensitive spiritual touches. KRS, One has been a leading figure in hip-hop for nearly 3 decades, while Mouse on Mars has made a music career out of dissolving the boundaries between different strains of electronic music. On Monday, the festival added Moses Sumney, whose 2017 album, Aeroromanticism, is a stirring rumination on intimacy. A single music festival can't fix centuries of toxic power dynamics or their trickle-down elements. But it can at least push us toward thinking about pulling those systems apart, offering an extra spark in this long march toward gender-blind equality. Sights Unseen. Lower your lids and open your third eye with the sublime spiritual techno of John Hopkins. If 2013's Immunity promoted John Hopkins from respected niche taste to noted techno auteur, his brand new album Singularity enshrines him as one of today's most visionary, ambitious producers. We reached the Moogfest headliner, who heroically stepped in on deadline day and took over an important lounge after Chelsea Manning's canceled her interview with us to learn more about the spiritual dimensions that are so clearly but abstractly present in his music, how his two similarly named albums related to each other and thrust forward a trilogy, and his holistic approach to albums in an age that tends to favor the track. Indie. Your albums are such deep listening experiences, and they happen so much in controlled stereo space. How do you translate that to a live show? He answered, the first step is separating every sound out. Often, I'll reduce a lot of the stereo complexity or just becomes messy. So even though it may sound emotionally similar to the record, a lot of layers have been taken out. I've also revisited the tracks from Immunity and primed them to sit alongside the new ones. And he said, am I to assume you build in visual elements? He said, yeah, that's a big part of it. It's a good opportunity to really think about how these tracks should look, which is something I don't really think about while writing. And he said, that's interesting, because to me, your music is so visual, but you're not even thinking about the visuals when you're making it. He said, yeah, it's funny. I've noticed that people have very different responses to the visual side. A lot of people see very specific things. I don't. To me, they're kind of like dimensional abstract spaces and shapes, complex, almost like buildings or rooms with objects in them. I'll meet one person who gets one landscape from it, and another who gets a whole new series of colors from the same track. Sometimes it shows you see people standing with their eyes shut, and I love that. In some ways, that's the purest approach. The indie went on, that must be cool to see people with their eyes closed and imagine all different things they're seeing, everybody in their own world with this piece of music that you made. He said, that's the beauty of music. It's a language that says things you can't say in words, but one where people hear different things. I always find it remarkable, the effects of music on the brain. The indie went on, your music feels like a brain to me. It's very psychological in some ways. But I also understand from the recent New Yorker article that this album follows a seeking period in your life. Can you tell us about your life leading up to this record and how it seeped in? He said, yeah. I think every record I make is a distillation of what's happened, not just when I'm writing, but particularly before that. It was a period of burnout following too much touring and the insomnia I developed. Seeking solutions plunged me deep into meditation, which is something I was familiar with already. But I learned new types, transcendental in particular, and I also just found myself having a lot of visionary experience with natural psychedelics. It was this opening up of consciousness. Whatever mood, whatever transitions that were occurring in the brain, they will come out in the music whether you like it or not. In a way, it made for a potentially riskier album in that it's quite a lot more open-hearted and wears its heart on its sleeve, to use two cheesy heart references. With the last record, Immunity, in London particularly, it's a safer bet to make a sort of dark, heavy thing than it is to become a sparkly spiritual record. I became very convinced that I had to do exactly what I felt. It was an amazingly complicated process at first, but as I got towards the end of things, things started seeming to fall into place. It ended up being as magical an experience to write as I hope people will have listening to it. And Andy, I always had this latent sense that, okay, this is someone who does yoga or reads Carlos Castaneda. He said, I got the book. I haven't read it yet. I need to read it. And he said, you'll love it. Great tour reading. So, Immunity, Singularity. It feels like a trilogy for me. He said, you're absolutely right. I even had the third name. Are you sharing that name yet? He said, no. The second one's been out a week. Fair. Can you talk about those concepts and how they relate to each other, and also how they differentiate between the two albums, Immunity and Singularity? He said, I haven't thought about that in relation to each other that much. So much of this happens on instinct. There was an element of using music almost as a shield back then. The name Immunity came from this feeling that I get when music's going well. If you're writing something that is really, truly, that lights you up, the world feels like a different place, hopeful and positive. So that was music as a shield and as a release, maybe. There's quite a lot of aggression in the music as well, and there is on this album too, particularly in the first half. But with Immunity, there's also more nihilism, maybe less clarity about what I really wanted to transmit. On this one, the concepts are bigger. Immunity was kind of looking in, introverted, while Singularity has a feeling of vastness in a way they're completely opposing. The ending went on, it would be interesting to see how you resolve that opposition in the third part of the trilogy. He said, I know that it's going to have to be very different. I feel like, with this one, I've taken this exact combination of styles, at least rhythmically, as far as I can. In the end, he said, well, as long as the title ends in E-T, I-T-Y, we'll be fine. So, John, I've always had this sense that you approach albums holistically, not just like collections of tracks. How does this whole start to come into view for you? Yeah, that's really important to me. People ask, why do you bother doing this when no one listens to it anyway? My response is always, I can't always make it my business how people consume. All I can do is make it exactly how I see it being made. At the beginning, of course, you have no real idea, but really quite early on, it starts forming into a whole, and I can imagine the kind of line graph of it. It will become apparent what the first track is, and it just allows you to go sonically piece together a narrative. The songs should work in isolation, but the way they affect each other can exponentially improve the experience. For me, an hour is a perfect amount of time. I just love that format. There are many people who refuse to just listen to the single because they've heard me talking about this, which is just lovely. Next, Moog Brief, Chelsea's next chapter. What does a music festival have to do with activism toward a more open government? On the surface, not much, which makes Chelsea Manning, who rocketed towards international recognition when she was imprisoned in 2010 for leaked scores of confidential documents about the United States' wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it seems like an odd choice for MoogFest's keynote address. But her advocacy for openness transfers pretty seamlessly to creative communities that likewise benefit from enthusiastic exchanges of ideas. President Barack Obama commuted Manning's sentence in his final days in office and since reentering civilian life as exactly a year ago. And Manning has plunged herself headfirst into progressive activism. Her list of causes feels almost interminable. A free press, Palestine, labor rights, and universal health care are all her faves, unlike fracking, racism, transphobia, the current president, and immigration and customs enforcement. She touts her cause on Twitter with cheery, emoji-adorned hashtag WeGotThis encouragement. What most of her missives have in common, though, is a dedication to fostering connections among all people regardless of race, class, gender, or nationality. Now Manning is working on a book about her time in prison as she's mounting a bid for a Senate post in Maryland. At MoogFest, however, she'll focus on discussing how privacy laws and a perpetually morphing digital world will shape creativity. Manning's busy schedule and engagement with so many social critics causes indicate that she's not content to settle down and take it easy, despite having spent the last few years in a government ringer. If she can continue to channel that energy into meaningful action, whether it's in Washington, D.C., online or both, Manning stands to grow into one of this generation's most powerful advocates against oppression. Next article, Circular Listening. A new audio system installed at the Amory wraps the audience in 360 degrees of music. When Hans Scherron set out to design a new home for the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in the early 1960s, he was inspired by his own observation that people listening to street performances naturally arrange themselves in a circle. Scherron went on to develop a concert hall with seating patterns that surround the stage, giving the audience unprecedented clarity to hear every pluck of a violin string, every bellow of a horn, and every boom of a bass drum. Decades later, researchers at Virginia Tech and Meyer Sound are exploring ways to bring immersive audio engineering into the 21st century with a novel spatial audio system that makes its debut at MoogFest. The immersive sound design system, called Audio Cubed, or A3, will be employed for 9 sets at the Armory. The setup, which uses 24 independent speakers to create a multidivisional sound, is the culmination of a partnership between Virginia Tech's Institute for Creativity, Arts and Technology, and Meyer Sound, an innovative audio engineering company in Berkeley, California. Preliminary research for the A3 system took place in Virginia's Tech's Cube, a multidisciplinary facility used for sound experiments and cutting-edge art installations. The Cube can utilize up to 150 speakers, leading Virginia Tech to claim that it's home to one of the largest multi-channel audio systems in the world. Ryan McHugh, a graduate student at Virginia Tech who serves as marketing and publicity coordinator for the A3 program, says those speakers can be arranged in nearly limitless combinations in order to closely mimic sounds in the natural environment. You hear in spatial audio all the time. There's sound above you, beneath you, around you, McHugh explains. But it's difficult for performers to replicate that sensation in real time, especially since most venues traditionally place outward-facing speakers only at the front of the stage. A3 is different in that its speaker arrangement allows the audience to experience a 360-degree field of audio. That wider range of immersion and flexibility is useful across genres, from the aggressive industrial doom metal of Arthur and Punisher to less classical compositions from Vegard Sigurdsson. Some artists work with audio engineers, Tanner Upgrove and Mike Rowan, to rehearse songs that they created specifically for their sets at the Armory. Meanwhile, the German electronic duo Mouse on Mars and the experimental hip-hop group Shabazz Palaces traveled to Berkeley to practice with Meyer Sound in preparation for their A3 performances. McHugh explains that the field of spatial audio engineering is still in its early stages. Most spatial audio work has been experimental and research-oriented, and it's especially rare for these types of systems to be employed at such a large scale for popular performances. A3 also represents a new nexus between art and science, a kind of avant-garde approach to a scientific inquiry about how best to replicate sounds in a controlled environment. McHugh thinks these experiments can scale up, too. They're looking at putting A3 in bigger halls, coliseums, huge venues with hundreds and thousands of speakers that would all be specifically designed for an acoustic, sonic, 360-degree experience, McHugh says. We feel like we've kind of been on the cusp of what the next step is in concert experience. The next article, Deep Cuts. Kalila's future pop transformatively draws on the music of the African diaspora. On October 1, 2013, electro R&B futurist Kalila Mitsakantristos debuted her inaugural mixtape, Cut For Me. The 13-track effort, released through Los Angeles-based indie label Fade to Mind, was a deliciously grimy synth-informed foray through dubstep, R&B, hip-hop, and a fusion of other adjacent genres and futuristic sounds. As a young transplant to New York City, where the world of underground clubs and niche pockets of subculture had opened me up to new iterations of multidimensional blackness, many of which I felt finally reflected my own experiences, Cut For Me felt intimate and absolutely soul-searing. The project became a soundtrack to my newfound sense of freedom. I had finally left the small white town of my childhood and migrated out of the South where I'd attended university. I had also entered my first real relationship with a woman, and though wonderful friends, I was slowly coming to terms with being queer. And the fact that being so as a daughter of an African immigrant wasn't the end of the world, or the end of a relationship with a mother, as I also secretly feared it might be. Living and partying in Brooklyn was my first real exposure to a community of creatives from the Black diaspora and beyond, who didn't see my broad interest and tastes as the trappings of the weird Black girl, as had frequently occurred in my childhood. In fact, discovering these communities and falling in love with musicians like Kalila, who fearlessly rejected world-imposed labels and announced their presence by being uncompromisingly themselves, made my own desire for self-discovery feel more pressing and necessarily than ever before. Born in 1983 in Washington, D.C., to immigrant parents, Kalila's childhood as a second-generation Ethiopian-American was informed by an innate familial connection to the African diaspora. The music of Miriam Makeba was just as commonplace as the sounds of New Jersey jack swing and the electric energy of Janet Jackson. She had also fallen in love with R&B singers like Kelly Rowland and experimentalists like Bjork, whom she has cited as an enduring influence. These interests were also supplemented by a driving curiosity and desire to discover the cultural movements and moments happening around her. She first became enamored with electronic music through a random Napster download. In her fall 2017 Fader cover story, the singer shared that her parents immigrated from the Horn of Africa during the 70s. Both attended university on affirmative action scholarships for African students. As Kalila related to writer Lincoln Starling, the young couple met through a campus student movement that advocated for radical institutional change. This progressive, change-minded ethos is a quiet hallmark of Kalila's music and her interaction with the world as an artist and an intellect. Yet far from the days of Cut For Me, 2015's Hallucinogen, or last year's Take Me Apart, Kalila was an inspiring singer who believed her journey was destined to start when she was accepted to the prestigious Duke Ellington School of the Arts. As she told Fader, she was unable to attend due to the high tuition costs. Instead, she spent formative years in D.C.'s spoken word and performance cafes. She grew interested in jazz music and soon taught herself to scat and sing difficult jazz standards. She also became a fixture in and around Mount Pleasant, the neighborhood where D.C.'s underground punk and metal scene thrived. And though she has said that the white, male-dominated nature of the scene could sometimes feel restrictive, it also became a space for experimentation. Like her experiences, Kalila's work is innately global, spanning continents, disparate isochic sonic landscapes, and experimental new genres. In channeling these interests, her music transformation to something that is inclusive and celebratory of otherness in an organic way. As far back as Cut For Me, Kalila has worked with a global roster of artists and producers with whom she creates a bridge that sonically connects the Black diaspora and provides a glimpse into the promise of the future sounds. Hallucinogen, for instance, features production from London-based Night Slugs founder Bok Bok, who melds wildly different genres like Detroit house, Chicago footwork, and drill music with Goom, a South African strain of house music that's finally enjoying some well-deserved popularity statewide. Los Angeles's Daniel Pineda and Ismael Marouf, together known as Naguruzaguzu, also work within a similar scope, combining music, R&B, with genres like Zouk and Kizumba, which originate from Angola. Kalila's work with Venezuelan producer Arcas, whose Frankenstein-esque pseudo-hip-hop production have attracted the attention of Bjork and Kanye West, also take global cues. Her latest project and debut studio albums, Take Me Apart, continues the groundwork Cut For Me and Halogenes and Laid. Hazy, future-facing, and ultimately beautifully empowering, Take Me Apart is a deeply Afrofuturist work that explores our relationships with love, loss, and autonomy in a vulnerable, relatable way that takes you apart and puts you back together in the best way possible. For many of us who feel that the spaces we occupy safely are spaces on the fringe, artists like Kalila truly embody the beauty of otherness and cross-culture experiences. In her careful hands, the things that at one time might have made some of us painfully, others are broadened and transmuted into something joyous and blindingly ethereal. A Moog Brief, Bloody Brilliant. Jenny Haval opens her 2015 record Apocalypse Girl with a set of instructions. Think big girl like a king, she says with the slow, intentional patience of king size. A few seconds later, she poses the question, what is soft dick rock? It may be a jarring start for those unfamiliar with Hall's work, but it's a hallmark of her talent for pushing listeners out of their comfort zones. Haval isn't just a gifted experimental musician with a knack for wry turns of phrase. She's making some of the most unusual and affirming music of the decade. Hall's work can be called feminist. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So, until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.